At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Make headlines in F1 2018, the official video game of Formula One. Coming to PlayStation 4 and Xbox One on August 24th. Get exclusive cars if you pre-order now.
Rob Zachney,
what did that mean?
That means long time no see in Flemish.
Outstanding. And that is the official language of the Belgian GP?
I don't know.
As I understand it, there are actually no language controversies or cultural divisions at all whatsoever in Belgium. And I'm sure the Flemish greeting will go down smoothly and well with all Belgians.
Absolutely. Nope, they don't speak anything else, not Dutch or any variant thereof. Yes, we're racing in Belgium. I'm Drew Scanlon. That's Rob Zachney. Danny O'Dwyer is on dad duty. What is the word I'm looking for?
Paternity.
That's it. I almost said Patreon leave. That's different.
No, this is like the opposite of Patreon leave.
Yes. But yes, welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. We don't actually have a last race to talk about because we discussed Hungary last time over the mid-season break. But thankfully, Rob Zachney, the mid-season break is coming to a close because, oh my God, I don't know how much longer I can go without race cars.
I am really looking forward to this race. It's always a little bittersweet because I would say the European part of the calendar is my favorite because it's got a lot of the the classic F1 circuits.
Sure.
in a lot of ways, but at the same time, like, it'll be good to have it back, and I do love this racetrack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great track to come back to because it is so iconic, the Spa-Francorchamps track, and we've actually only got one more Italian race after that. It's Belgium and then Italy, and then we go around to Singapore, Russia, Japan, the United States, Mexico, Brazil, and Abu Dhabi. So it's a hello goodbye for Europe. But yeah, Spa's awesome.
No, I mean, it's one of those tracks. This used to be a really common sort of archetype for F1 circuits, right? The old, like, yep, we just there was a forest, there were hills, we just put a track over them, and we're just gonna run some cars around. Yeah. And it's sort of like this holdover from a much more like naturalistic approach to circuit design. Cause like it was just,
I'd say cavalier, maybe.
Cavalier is a great way of putting it. If you look at sort of the casualty lists, for the old days, especially if you like look at, have you ever seen, I think the movie's just Grand Prix, right? I think it's a Frankenheimer movie with James Garner. It's with James Garner.
I've never seen it. No,
It's like it's a melodrama, but it's got a ton of onboard footage from that era. It's Frankenheimer, like the master of shooting automotive chase sequences and races, and I think he like shot it in like 70mm or something like that. And
wow.
It's all vintage F1 footage, and a lot of it at the old circuits. And I think it is Spa, actually, that has one of the more dramatic incidents in the movie, which is one of the racers who has mixed feelings about Formula One. Like, it's again classic racing melodrama. Like the big one of the big tensions of this movie is this dude basically being like, I must keep racing. I don't know if I should. And like the job of the woman in this story is to be like, don't you see what it's doing to you? It's not worth it. Why do you risk everything for racing? And he's like, because it is the best sport in the world. And it proves I'm a man. And that's basically how he's rolling until, like, there's an accident and he, like, takes out, like, a bunch of spectators in Belgium. But the footage in Belgium, and this is the sort of stuff that happened back in the day, the footage from that era and that you see in the movie, literally, like, they would just be racing those old cars down, like, a country road, like, packed with, like, spectators. It was like a rally. Yeah. It was like rally racing today.
Which still freaks me out.
It freaks me out. In rally racing, it's dangerous enough. But, like, the idea that that's how it used to be in F1, that everyone was just cool with the fact that you'd be barreling along, like, a forested road in an open-wheel race car with, like, dodgy suspensions. And everyone was like, yeah, that seems normal. Let's put people there.
This track specifically, it used to be gigantic. I think it was like 19 miles or something. And it would go throughout the forest. And there weren't people all along the track. There were like some spectator spots. But then there was like big sections of track where cars would just disappear and not come around again. People would go like, huh, wonder where he is. And then like find him hours later. Yeah.
This is one of those, so years ago, there was this ghost-written book. It was like Jackie Stewart's first autobiography, but this one was written by a ghostwriter, and it was just called Faster, and I think the guy's name was like Mancuso or something like that. And really, like, it's clearly in the ghostwriter's voice more than Jackie Stewart's little bit. The guy's other automotive work was called Vroom. That was literally the title, Vroom. But the book is pretty interesting because it's an account of the year that Jochen Rindt won the F1 Drivers' Championship posthumously. And he was a good friend of Jackie Stewart's. But one of the things that Stewart like makes a point of mentioning in this book is that like he wasn't a fool. Like he wasn't going to just like die for no good reason in F1. So he would like contract to have his own medical team brought along to these events. Because like the racing organizers didn't provide a response that was worth a damn. So like Stewart always made sure that like there was an ambulance and technicians like on his payroll that were there just for him. Wow. if he got into trouble. But yeah, the fact that like in those old days, you'd literally have that. Well, they sort of disappeared. They're out there somewhere.
Yeah. There's a movie called One. It's a documentary that is basically about that. It's about Jackie Stewart in those eras or in that era, basically having to do it all himself. And it's actually really a good movie. But yeah, Spa is one of those legendary tracks. It's in the Ardennes Forest, which is the site of the Battle of the Bulge, which is really awesome. I actually looked up the like the map, and this is basically as far as the Germans swung right before Spa.
Okay.
So it's right on basically the front lines, which was pretty cool. It's 7 kilometers long nowadays, or 4.3 miles. And has got a number of iconic corners. Of course, Eau Rouge, which pretty much everyone can recognize if you've ever seen an F1 commercial or a promo or a photograph or anything. It's that big rise that turns to the right and then the left as it comes to the top of the hill.
And you take it flat out and blind.
Yes. Yes. Especially in these new cars. It used to be that you would have to lift in some of the old cars, but these days it's a flat out curve and that you cannot see the top of the hill when you go up it. But the rest of the track is great too. It's got a lot of straights, chicanes. It's a nice mix. And we've got a longer DRS straight actually at the top of Eau Rouge, down into I don't know if it's a 90 degree right hander at the end of it.
Oh, it's the 90-90-90. Yeah, it's Lacombe.
Yeah.
It's Lacombe. A fast right hander into the lead straight into a fast left and then a fast right again. And then I think you start beginning your downhill run at that point.
Yeah. And then it's not a hairpin, but it's a 180 degree turn.
Yeah.
And then you got some long turns. Puhon's pretty long. And then you've got some more left and rights. And then back all the way down to the start finish straight, and right before it is another chicane, and then you've got the start finish line, which actually culminates in a hairpin before you go to Eau Rouge. So it's got a lot of stuff going on.
I love this track so much. Like, this is probably the one I've driven in sims more than any other. Like, every time I get a new racing sim, I'm like, all right, well, I just need to see how the cars handle, so I'll go to Spa and just see what's up. But each sector of this track is so different, and I think the thing I love about that back half of the circuit is that you can take it blindingly fast, but you have to really like nail each corner complex, or else you're going to lose more speed than you can recover, right? Like, mm-hmm. you really need to have like the perfect line, especially in that last sector, like as you clear the Stavolo turn and you enter this like series of really fast turns that you basically take flat. But again, you need to make sure you're properly set up for all of them. It's really great. And then there's the, I don't know, I'm always amazed at where they choose to start this race. You know, the old, like, a lot of other series, I think, start on the run-up to Eau Rouge. F1 starts in a dive into the Lessors hairpin.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of chance for chaos at a yeah. hairpin. That's kind of fun. Maybe they don't want people going tight through Eau Rouge. It might be a safety yeah, thing, actually. Like, you spread out a little bit before you actually get there. Yeah, I mean, a lot of really great moments have happened here throughout the years. most recently, Ocon and Perez got together near the wall twice in one race, which is one of the scariest onboards I have ever seen, and I will link to it. I think it's Ocon getting squeezed to the wall. And they're going like 200 miles an hour on the way up to Eau Rouge. It's so scary. Yeah, and there's also,
sorry, I was just gonna ask, like, is that, I think that is like the first moment where it started to become clear that there was just a poisonous relationship in that team's camp, that those two drivers just would not, like, you know, there are teams that let their drivers race, and then there's cases where like the drivers actively appear to hate each other, and that that's where it like was clear that was the case at Force India, because like you don't even make that move on like guys from other teams, right? Like, you yeah. generally don't squeeze drivers that hard and like try to put them into the wall. Schumacher did a couple times, and he was probably as bare knuckle as you ever saw. But you don't see it between teammates that often. It was a ruthless move.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was before or after Azerbaijan, where they also came together. I think it might have been after, but this was like, man, they are not letting up. Because usually that, if that happens one time with a couple teammates, they get the talking to from the team and then they're good. But this one, you're right. It yeah. was clear that they were like, there's some bad blood there.
It was Perez putting the squeeze on Ocon, who had the run. Like, there's no reason to make that move. Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Also, one of my favorite animated GIFs that has come out of F1 is this onboard from Alonso in 2012. It's the start of the race, and he's coming to the hairpin, and he turns a corner, and then suddenly Roman Grosjean's car just cartwheels in front of the camera. And you're like, how could that possibly have happened? How did a car go from behind me to just rotating in front of me across my view? I will also link that. F1 has a pretty good onboard shot of that as well.
And then you can find it, and F1 seems to do a bad job of archiving a lot of their classic duels, which I don't fully get. But like Hamilton and Raikkonen in 2008 had this amazing duel on like a slightly wet track. So it was like mixed conditions, and they were just running flat out, and they both like... They were both well beyond traction, so they kept like running on and off the circuit, and they're really pushing the limits of like, did you really give back the racing advantage you got from like running wide there or like cutting a chicane? It was very controversial after the fact. I think the stewards even took away Hamilton's position at the end of the race because he hadn't handed back a position or hadn't handed back the time advantage he gained. But it's an amazing. It was a great duel, and it was really one of those moments where you realized that Hamilton was going to be something. Like, you did not see that many drivers being that fearless in 2008.
Wow. Okay. I also, because I was starved for racing, I watched the 1998 Belgian Grand Prix, which is on F1 TV's archives. And holy smokes, so many things happen in that race. I won't spoil it if people want to watch it, but things, you might watch it and go, okay, the interesting part is over, I can stop watching this race, but amazing things keep happening in it. So there are some red flags that you can skip through, of course.
Yeah.
But man, that's a good one. And it is one of the few on F1.TV's or F1TV's archive. I'm actually going to jump down to the Twitter section here and call out at Call Me Little G, who says to Shift F1 Podcast on Twitter, cracking Andrew Benson article on Fernando's exit from F1. Spoilers for the news. Especially this list of greatest hits. We'll definitely look these up. Perhaps something for Shift F1 Podcast fans in the summer break. And then he links to a BBC article that basically says, like, look at how awesome Alonso was. Valencia 2012, Imola 2005, Singapore 2010, Japan 2008, Italy 2007, Malaysia 2012. All these amazing things that Fernando Alonso has done. None of those races are available on F1 TV archive. So I'm not sure why that thing exists.
It's so frustrating because, like, you see the perennial complaint that, like, the series has become a little boring. There's not enough overtaking action. Like, what's cool about F1? And they've made it very hard to show people, like, well, this is the stuff that, like, we talk about for years later, and this is the stuff we live for. Like, you know, like that 2008 race just kind of vanished. You can watch the 2000 duel between Hakkinen and Schumacher if you want to see that rivalry at, like, one of its best moments. Really kind of, I think, crystallizes the two drivers' styles and strengths. So that's a good video to look up. But yeah, it is shocking how poorly archived F1 history is.
Yeah, and I gotta believe that there's all kinds of weird rights stuff associated with that. And then when they put it up, they want it to be in good condition. So maybe some restoration has to be done, because I imagine a lot of that stuff is on tape.
Yeah.
But you know, they do have I think race recaps, like little 5 to 10 minute edited pieces, but I don't want that. I want to be able to go back to, like, 1991 and watch the whole season. That's what I want. And currently that is not possible to do. I don't even think they have any full seasons, even like last year, which is what?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
The
recent stuff, how do you not have that uploaded?
Yeah. A few more stats from Formula One themselves on Spa and the drivers. Lewis has retired here 4 times, more than any other track. Raikkonen has won here the most at 4. Hamilton's got 3 wins and Vettel has 2. This weekend will be Hamilton's 111th start for Mercedes. 111st if you're Bilbo Baggins, surpassing his career total at McLaren at 110. He's the only man to make 100 Grand Prix starts for 2 different teams. And the only driver to make 200 starts for 1 engine manufacturer. Dude has raced a lot. Raikkonen is seeking the 100th podium finish of his career this weekend, something only previously achieved by Schumacher, Hamilton, Prost, and Vettel. Despite a good finishing record here, with 1 win and 2 podium finishes, Ricciardo has never started in the top 4 on this track and has only outqualified a teammate once, Dan Kvyat in 2015. Verstappen has never finished higher than 8th in 3 starts at Spa and has never completed a lap in the top 4. And the most successful track of his F1 career so far, Hülkenberg has twice finished 4th at Spa, but only once at any other circuit, Korea, in 2013, and has still never had a podium finish after 147 starts. I'm calling it. Hülkenberg gets a podium. Spa. Colin.
Bold prediction.
Very.
What's your ranking in Fantasy F1? Just trying to gauge the quality of that prediction. How you doing?
151st.
Okay, so maybe don't take that to the bank. But
ooh, he's on my team.
Yeah,
he's on my fantasy team. Okay, but the weather for Spa always plays a big part, especially because it's one of those tracks where it's got microclimates. It can be raining on one side and sunny on another. Qualifying day looks to be, let's see, kind of chilly, 57 Fahrenheit or 14 Celsius at race time with 63% humidity. Decent wind, 11 miles an hour or 18 kilometers an hour, and precipitation looks to be 25% on qualifying day. Nothing in terms of precip on race day, but similar humidity, higher temps, 62 degrees Fahrenheit, 17 Celsius, and lower wind. So qualifying, fingers crossed, should be pretty awesome. Pirelli tires, tire information. We've got medium, soft, and super soft. This track is tough on tires. 5 for tire stress and lateral force, 4 on asphalt grip, 2 on downforce, and 3 for asphalt abrasion. We're doing 44 laps for a grand total of 308 kilometers. Sebastian Vettel holds the lap record from 2017. I could not be more excited for a race. I mean, this is it's second only to the start of the season is the restart. Especially now because we can kind of look at, we're looking ahead to next year with all the driver announcements and stuff. Which I think we should just jump right into with the news. As we said, Alonso dropped the bomb that he would not be returning to racing in F1 in 2019. There are a lot of caveats to that. He basically left the door open. If anyone wants him after 2019, he'll be around.
Oh, interesting.
So he just
does not want to drive for McLaren in F1.
I think he wants a competitive car.
Yeah,
is the deal. And like we've said before, he might not get that, even though he's arguably the best driver, because he's burned so many bridges. So, who knows?
It's interesting. Like, I don't know if we talked about this in the last show, but, Horner made that comment. Christian Horner at Red Bull made that comment that, you know, as he is wont to do, he got a little off the cuff and just started like sharing his feelings and thoughts about things. Follow Christian at Blogspot. No, he mentioned that, like, you know, has a ton of admiration for Alonso, but I think he said like the guy causes chaos wherever he goes.
Yeah.
Basically, was the what was his verdict? Which I'm really curious. What's behind that? Like, I gotta believe that Horner's got a pretty good sense of what's talked about in the paddock. It's true, the guy has had drama throughout a lot of his career. Remember, like, his time at Renault kind of came to an end when Nelson Piquet Jr. Was sort of caught in that cheating scandal where he had right. that, like, planned crash that he sort of coordinated with Flavio Briatore. And, you know, so there's that issue. There's the fact that, like, he went over to McLaren and immediately had that poisonous relationship with Hamilton. But was that all on Alonso? I don't know. It didn't seem like there was that much drama at Ferrari. It just seemed like the team kind of sucked. But I don't know. It's a weird thing where after a certain, like, you could say his instincts have always been kind of bad about when to jump to a team. He's had bad luck, but enough bad luck at a certain point, people start wondering, like, is it you? And I think that's kind of where Alonso's ended up, like, behind the wheel, unparalleled.
You know, but that's not everything.
In the garage. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. He's a fun guy to watch. So, I would be curious to see what he would be like in an IndyCar season. There are continued rumors of him going there for a full season. He's already doing a lot of World Endurance Championship races, although the whole Toyota team, all three cars, got disqualified from the last race because of some technical infraction. I don't know. I can't be excited about World Endurance Championship when there's only really two teams in the top series?
Yeah, I mean, so my attitude is you have to start following for like the top tier, like GT Pro, I think is the sweet spot. Like that is amazing racing action. And that is the series to really follow. But yeah, like it does have this problem that the top tier of the prototype cars, it's just nobody has the interest or budget to sustain a world-class program for that long. Like Toyota's cleaning up right now basically because they're just like, damn it, we've got all these sunk costs. We're going to see this through and we get our trophies. And then probably they're probably going to get bored and leave eventually, as everyone else who has done this has eventually done.
Yeah. So they'll make like Alonso and leave. So after Ricciardo went to Renault and Alonso dropped the bomb that he will be leaving McLaren, Sainz then went from Renault to McLaren to replace his fellow Spaniard, which then everyone was like, well, then that kind of makes it easy. Who's going to go to Red Bull then? It's Pierre Gasly. And he has indeed been confirmed for Red Bull to pair against with Max Verstappen, which I think is a good, you know, he has impressed next to Brendan Hartley, which I think you can only, you know, be compared against your teammate, really.
I thought you were about to say something really mean.
And I think he'll be a fun one to watch. So that whole loop has been closed. Ricciardo to Renault, Sainz to McLaren, Gasly to Red Bull, but we still have a lot of unconfirmed
and Van
drivers.
Dorn.
Yeah. Van Dorn question mark.
Pointedly not getting the vote of confidence from the team at this point.
You would think that if he was a lock, they would have locked him down, which is kind of what you could say about everything here. Raikkonen, if Ferrari believes him to be like Mr. Solid, dependable guy, why haven't they locked him down?
I felt bad. I saw this interview with Kimi where he's like, yeah, I'd like to know. My family would like to know. And at a certain point, it's like kind of shitty to think about, like, even these dudes at like the pinnacle of motorsport, right? Like, world champion, one of the most talented drivers in the world, and you're still kind of getting jerked around at the end of your career by your boss. I don't know, it was one of the most human like things I've heard from Kimi, where it was one of the most relatable things I've heard from Kimi about this, like, look man, I'm trying to make plans with my family and shit, like, do I have this job or not? And I kind of felt for him in that moment. I was like, damn, like, you shouldn't do Kimi like that.
Yeah, I just think a conservative company like Ferrari, especially when you've got a driver like Vettel, it doesn't make sense to drop Raikkonen.
No.
For some young gun, even though Leclerc is really fun to watch and is another driver that is smoking his teammate, and who I really, really like. I don't think that's Ferrari's MO, right? Although if Ferrari stays at Ferrari, or if Raikkonen stays at Ferrari, I don't know what happens to Leclerc. Sauber isn't doing so bad, so he could just stay there. But personally, I'd like to see him at Haas. I think Magnussen seems solid, so you keep him. Grosjean, though, hasn't really impressed this season. I kind of hate to do Grosjean like that, because like, it's kind of like, what have you done for me lately?
Many mistakes. Too many... Like, it's not just bad luck, just lapses that you can't have at this point.
Yeah. Maybe put him in Sauber. I don't know. I don't think it really goes like that.
No.
Sauber, though, has also not confirmed anyone. Neither has Haas. So, you got to believe Ericsson sticks around because he brings with him some dough. Toro Rosso, Hartley didn't really impress, but Gasly's already gone. So do you need an elder statesman there to, you know, mentor a newbie, or do you just, you know, cut your losses and say, all right, two new dudes going at Toro Rosso? That one, I don't know.
Red Bull's kind of in a weird position with their driver pipeline, right now. I think the sport in general is developing like an increasing youth bias that I'm not sure is statistically like borne out in terms of results. But at this point, like the primary team at Red Bull is going to be a really young garage, really young duo.
Yeah.
Now you can say like it's a really experienced organization. Like they're going to be surrounded by people who've been to this rodeo many, many times. Like Christian Horner is a driver himself. He's been doing this for years. Like there's a lot of possibilities for mentorship there. At the same time, it does sort of seem like I've always suspected that there's some utility to the like have your, you know, your young gun, your star, your future ace, and then have sort of a Mr. Reliable in the form of a like Rubens Barrichello or a Felipe Massa, somebody who like, you know, they will give you a good understanding of what the car is and can do, and they will also be someone who can be a resource for the younger driver. That doesn't appear to be an option Red Bull have left themselves.
Hmm. Yeah. I think you're right. They just, I don't know. I'm sure they have, I mean, I know they have a lot of other drivers waiting in the wings, but in terms of like, are they ready for F1? That's, I mean, we're going to have to see. McLaren also has a driver waiting in the wings. He's Formula 2 driver and McLaren driver program member Lando Norris, who's also doing a free practice session at Spa. So he's the other guy in potential for McLaren with Van Dorn. Force India, we'll get to them. They've got a lot of things going on. We mentioned last time that Stroll's dad came and bought the team. So does Stroll come in? What happens then? What happens to Williams? Sorotkin probably sticks around. Does Robert Kubica come in?
Oh, man, that would...
Robbie K is just sitting here.
I will back any reshuffle that gets Kubica a drive. I would be so hyped for that.
I saw some quote of his saying he was driving a car years ago, back when he was in F1, and like had to cover... was like covering a hole in the floor or something as he was driving up Eau Rouge. So he took Eau Rouge with one hand and he said, well, I can basically put 80% of my hand strength in my right arm, or 80% of it's in his left hand and 20% is on his right arm now. So I would actually be driving with more hands than I was back then when I was trying to cover up a hole in a car. I would love to see that. I think that's a great comeback story. But yeah, the silly season is not over yet, and already it's looking to be like a fun 2019. I would love to see Magnussen at Ferrari, Kimi and Leclerc at Haas.
Okay.
Think about that.
But would Ferrari ever want to see Magnussen at Ferrari?
Absolutely not. No, Magnussen is way too much of a loose cannon.
Yeah. Kimi to Haas, I could see that being a useful... I don't know. It's a very strange thing right now. Like, the narrative started going against Kimi really badly, but, like, he's driven a good season overall.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm very curious about how all this is going to shake out. And the Leclerc X factor does make this incredibly hard to parse, because he has been like doing really well at Sauber, but that was a team that was kind of ready to pop. And again, there's the weird factor of Vettel does not want a rival. You know, Vettel does not want somebody who's going to come in and be like, you never want to be Fernando Alonso when Hamilton shows up at McLaren. Right.
Yeah.
Where like you're just, you know, you came here, this was going to be your show. Like you're the guy who's going to be running things. And then here comes a kid who doesn't give a shit about who you are, and that the organization really likes.
Yeah. I mean, Vettel dealt with, oh no, he didn't. I'm sorry. I thought I was going to say he dealt with Verstappen, but that was Ricardo.
Yeah. But he didn't get along with Ricardo either. Remember like when Ricardo started out driving him, when Red Bull was starting to struggle a little bit, you know, he tried to throw his weight around. He tried to get the team to, like, use team orders, and Ricciardo is like, remember there's that one, I want to say this might have been, like, in Australia, where they're like, you know, Seb's times are faster, but he's stuck behind you. And Ricciardo's response is basically just, well, that's too bad for him. And just, like, drove on, and that was the end of it. And yeah. Vettel left shortly thereafter. He doesn't like that. I think he's very much in the Schumacher mold of, like, he wants the best car, he wants to lead from the front, and he wants to drive, like, he just wants everything to be like clockwork. He can race if he needs to. He would really rather not, and he would really rather not race his teammate.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Still, fun stuff. And it's not over yet. But speaking of weird team troubles, Force India still not out of the woods. Apparently, we're getting more information about how that purchase of the team happened with Stroll's dad. Apparently, him and his group of investors needed permission from 13 Indian creditor banks to buy the company Force India. That wasn't going to happen in time, so they instead just bought the assets, like the car and the gear and stuff. Which means to enter a race, they now have to become a new company. So because they didn't buy the company, Force India is that team now, that car is no longer the old Force India car. So they would have to race as an entirely new entity. Under the rules. I don't see or not race at all. So I don't see Chase Carey allowing them to miss a race. I think for the sake of the show, he'll figure it out. But there is a rule saying that teams forfeit their right to a share of F1's revenues in the event of any change in legal status. That quote from racefans.net. I think by virtue of them losing their points, since they are effectively a new team. So this could hamper them in the future in terms of money if this does take place. Also, additionally, another consortium of potential buyers headed by the father of Force India development driver Nikita Mazepin is protesting Stroll's dad's maneuver, saying that that wasn't the right way to buy the company, and you should give it to us instead. So, bottom line, everything is confusing. Force India isn't out of the woods.
Yeah, like, just hearing that, I'm getting flashbacks to, like, trying to get my lease signed for my apartment. Just, like, I'm trying to imagine, like, going around, like, trying to, like, sort out a company that was in financial distress with, like, major debts to 13 different banks.
Yeah,
like, that sounds like a nightmarish deal to close. But at the same time, like, so the other thing, I think in one of these stories, there was a group of teams, like, who are pushing to deny permission to Force India to either race or to be granted continuation as being the same company, basically trying to, like, screw them out of their share of the revenue.
I imagine everyone behind them in the Constructors' Championship is trying to do that.
Yeah, entirely possible. Although, that also just, you know, the big, like, Ferrari's definitely been a team historically that gets very, like, if you're down, they will come along and knife you a little bit. So I could see them being one of the teams involved in that as well. But I really hope this gets worked out, especially because, like, if this team gets to continue, but they end up being considered, like, a new team and don't get their share of the money distribution from the season, you're going to start that team out by completely, like, kneecapping them.
Yeah.
Which is, like, is not what F1 needs.
No, it's not. And like I said, I think Chase Carey will do everything in his power to make the show go on, because they're a good team. But related to that is, for 2021, F1 is introducing much stricter cost regulations, and going forward, they're kind of tapering into that. So next year, according to racefans.net, there will be a soft budget cap, and then step down year after year after year to finally get to the 2021 regulations. And I think if I'm reading this article right, it'll be $150 million per team next year. Managing Director of Motorsport Ross Braun says, we only have to look at the situation Force India finds itself in to understand how crucial this is. The financial burden on teams is not sustainable in the long term, and we are taking steps to put a limit on how much a team can spend. Interestingly, he has consistently, in my opinion, been saying all the right things. And he has a really illustrative quote in this article that I didn't copy down. I'm trying to... Here we go. At the moment, I think a top team spends twice what a midfield team spends. And if we reduce that margin to around 10 or 20%, then there is something for the midfield teams to aspire to. There will still be an aura around the big teams, but a midfield team doing a great job will be able to compete. And I think this is the right attitude, because if you make it like, strict communism, then we're going to have something like NASCAR or, I don't know enough about IndyCar to say that about an IndyCar, but I don't know. I think this is the right way going forward.
Yeah. I don't know. I have a lot of mixed feelings about all this stuff, because I've never... as long as I've been watching F1, there have been two issues that come up again and again. How do we improve overtaking? Every year, that's like one of the discussions, and their answer like changes from year to year. We're going to drastically reduce the aerodynamic elements you can have, and then like 3 years later, they're like, it would really help overtaking, better aero. So that's something you see a lot. And then the other thing is, how do we fix the cost structure of F1? And I've always sort of wondered, like, there's definitely an element of it's just pure the midfield teams being outspent by the big teams. I've also always kind of suspected that by kind of radically revising the technical regulations, every couple of years, I suspect that is a lot harder for smaller teams to adjust to than the big ones. I've always sort of wondered if maybe that isn't the thing that, even more than just like raw spending power, is the thing that like sustains these gaps, is that after a certain point, like having to do all this fresh R&D for a new set of technical regs, that is not a huge ask if you're a car manufacturer with massive like facilities and R&D departments to tackle this. If you're not, then having a complete overhaul of what your car can be and can look like is going to put you in a hole that is just going to be very hard to dig out of. I think probably like enforcing some kind of cap is a good idea. I'm curious how you account for stuff like the fact that manufacturers have a lot of facilities that other teams might not have access to. Like, if you're Mercedes, can you do the like, well, we've got this wind tunnel and it's free. Can you play that game if you're a manufacturer? Yeah. I suspect you probably can. You're still charged for the time you book in the tunnel. But I don't know. I wonder the degree to which the technical stuff keeps the poor teams poor.
It's it's such a tricky situation. It's trying to be all things to everyone, and it just seems like an impossible task. So I do not envy Ross Braun one bit. I also do not envy the job of the Formula One broadcasters. Which we were treated to an amazing video that I originally saw in the ClothMap Discord kicking around. But this is the incident from Germany where Vettel goes off, or was it, sorry, not Germany. It was Germany? Yeah, it was Germany, where he goes off the track and hits the wall while he was leading. They take the footage and then overlay the audio of the control room of the broadcasters, so you are hearing the director telling what cameras to switch, you are hearing people saying like, I've got this shot, okay, take it, okay, ready on the helicopter, go to the track mix, keep this pan on Hamilton. It is like as a video nerd, especially one who did a lot of live switching for many years at Giant Bomb, it was so fascinating to watch, especially in like this really contentious or this really like high stress part of a race. Like there's a part where so Vettel runs into the wall and it's like hammering on the steering wheel, really angry. And they're like, stay on this, stay on this. And then there's a shot from the helicopter of him out of the car walking along. And then he like kicks a rock because he's so angry. And then everyone's like, yes, all right, good shot. Glad we stayed on that. It's super cool. And I will link that in the show notes.
God, live production always seems... I could not handle the stress. My friends who...
It's like 12 people talking at the same time.
Yeah, my friends who've done it, the other weird thing is my friends, like, when I was at Red Bull, I worked with some really good broadcast folks, and I swear to God it was, like, a narcotic for them after a point, though. Like, they hated the stress of prep, and, like, they became almost feral, like, on the eve of a show and, like, as a show began, but afterwards they were just, like, high out of their minds.
Yeah, I can totally sympathize with that. Yes. And you can hear it in their voices in this video. They're just like so amped up and so focused. I think that's really what I'm getting from it. Like imagine having that kind of intense focus for a solid 2 hours. Yeah, it's such a cool video and I'm glad F1 put that out. Yeah, really cool.
Drive fast, drive smart, make headlines in F1 2018, the official video game of Formula One that puts you behind the wheel of the fastest racing machines in the world. Make a name for yourself as you speed across international racing circuits to overtake your rivals in F1 2018's revamped career mode. Become the league's most respected or most infamous driver on the track. Be prepared to establish yourself off the track as well. Increase your value in contract negotiations. Answer intense on-the-fly press interviews. And build your F1 vehicle up to spec through improved R&D systems. The ultimate Formula One experience launches on August 24th on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Get to 2009 Braun and 2003 Williams classic cars if you pre-order now. Strap in for F1 2018. Make headlines.
Speaking of other things that F1 put out, their Beyond the Grid podcast continues to be really, really good. They just had one on with Jacques Villeneuve, who I had never really heard from before, aside, I knew that he was an ex-driver, and he was a Canadian, and has talked a lot of mess about Lance Stroll and how he's a rich kid. And so for that reason, I was like, okay, you're being pretty, all I've seen is from him is being abrasive, and apparently he is cut from that cloth, you know, the sort of James Hunt, I'm a race car driver, don't really care what anyone says. I think he's also a broadcaster for the Canadian F1 coverage, but, and while I still don't really, agree with what he says about Stroll a lot, I think he might be awesome because in this podcast, he noted that he collects, not only does he collect vintage computers, he also is and has been a huge gamer. Like down to leading raids in Dark Ages of Camelot,
which was not a baby MMO.
No.
Like Dark Age of Camelot was the real shit.
Yeah, and making sure that his like the Formula One motorhome had internet installed so that he could play.
God damn, I want to hang with this dude.
Yeah,
like it's so good. I love a guy who you just know has like a boot disc hanging around his like, oh yeah, this is the thing I use for my 486 build.
Yeah,
I want to hang with a guy like that. I saw his comments. He does bag on Stroll. I think tend to have some of the same prejudices about Stroll a little bit, so I tend to identify a little more with what Villeneuve is putting out there. But he's raising the bigger issue, which I do agree with, is this idea that, you know, basically racing has always been a, like kind of a rich kid sport, and a lot of like if you look at the names that repeat through racing history, like there's a degree of inherited status in F1.
Oh, yeah.
But like you know, one of the points he's raising is that literally if you're a middle class kid or something, like, there's not much point in trying to become a racer because, you know, just the development stages now are so expensive and so prohibitive for what they demand of young families of young racers. It's very hard to break in.
Yeah.
And I think that is a, I'm not sure there's a way that motorsports of all things, the most like just lighting piles of money on fire for the hell of it, I'm not sure there's any way to introduce like real economic justice or equal opportunity in motorsport, but it's really bad right now.
Yeah. I mean, actually same podcast, they interviewed Esteban Ocon, who his family basically sold their business and their home and moved into like a Winnebago and went around to karting races. That's what they had to do.
Yeah.
And I totally get all of that. I just don't know. I feel bad to see him just hating on Stroll for that reason alone. it's easy to do, and I get it, but it's, I think I've been trying to like characterize why it rubs me the wrong way. And I think it's because when you say that they got there only because of the money, you're kind of ignoring the hard work that everyone else has done. Like, it's, if it was only a matter of money, then you couldn't have possibly gotten there by talent. I don't know. I'm,
yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
No. Because I think I'm not sure your position actually like holds together that well. Like, I think Stroll's okay. Like, I think that there are drivers that come from wealthy backgrounds who do make a mark in, for like, I mean, Senna was from a very privileged background, right? If you watch Rush, like Niki Lauda, hardly a pauper. Like, definitely put his own money into his career, but he had family money he could draw on to get it done like that. But at the same time, like, from day one, these guys were, like, proving, hey, I'm not just here with, like, the silver spoon that, you know, got me this far. Like, I'm bringing some serious talent. And so you don't hear this line of attack brought up against those guys. You didn't even hear it. Well, I can't speak to like how Senna was greeted in the sport, but like, you generally don't hear that argument being opened up too much on drivers, except those who are like explicitly there because they have somebody's deep pockets and interest behind them. Like, I think if you're Lance Stroll and like you just haven't shown results yet, like you have, like, were, is this his second season or his third? Second, right?
I think it's his second full season.
Yeah. We've yet to have that moment where, like, and it's tough to judge because Williams has been in a bad spot for a while, but we've yet to have that moment where we're like, it's a bad car, but he's good in it. You know what I mean? Like, he is showing right. He's doing something that, like, he belongs in the sport. And instead what we're seeing is things aren't going at Williams. Dad may have just bought an F1 team, dude. Like, I mean, yeah. Stroll's a tough one to defend. He is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of privileged dudes in F1, but I think there's kind of a cynicism that attaches to pay drivers and people with, like, tons of family money, and I think Stroll's just going to have to carry that until he proves it. He could also maybe tell his dad to, like, maybe get his dad further back in the background a little bit. But yeah. if you need daddy out there making these big corporate moves to help secure you a decent ride, a lot of the drivers are going to talk. It's going to look rough when you're put up against the Ocons, who, you know, sank family money into it, Van Dorn, who, by all accounts, like, also had his family, like, really kind of give their all to get him this far. It's hard not to think about, like, what other talents don't get the opportunities that, like, a Stroll does, right? Like, how many great drivers are stuck down in lower tiers of racing because they're never going to have the ability to bring, like, multi-million-dollar packages to their career.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, yeah, again, like, I totally get it. I guess maybe I just don't like just ragging on someone because they had an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I haven't heard, you know, a long form interview with him. I don't know if he's actually cool or not. I may hate the guy's guts, but you know, I don't know. I don't like jumping to conclusions on people, I guess. But yeah, for sure, being rich helps very much in racing, as it does in a lot of things. So, yeah, he very clearly has an advantage. But Jacques Villeneuve seems like a huge nerd and a fun guy to hang out with. He also apparently reads fantasy and science fiction a lot. The interviewer even asked him, like, do you collect old computers like you collect old laptops? He's like, no, I'm talking about the 70s and 80s. Back then you had great games despite the terrible hardware. Today you have great games despite the terrible programming.
Wow. God yeah. Damn, what a line.
Yeah.
Jacques Villeneuve, go on Waypoint.
you should totally invite him on.
So hang on, did you see, by the way, the big interview that Zach Brown had with Race Fans?
I kind of skimmed through it a little bit. Did you read it more in depth?
I did. If we're talking about like just prejudices and people we take a weird stance against for reasons you can't totally justify, I guess Zach Brown is mine. I don't know. It's tough. He gave an interview, and it's clear, like, most reporters that he talks to, like, most of the coverage I see tends to be pretty positive toward, like, him personally and, like, how he comes across. But the point of his interview is basically, honestly, like, between the lines, he's playing defense. He's basically saying, like, it's, you know that story about, like, Khrushchev writing two letters when he sort of pushed out of power in the Soviet Union?
No.
Okay. So somebody reminded me of this. We were talking about Zach Brown online. It was a Shift F1 listener. I forget who it was. But it's a story I remember pretty well, which is that Khrushchev loses power, and he tells his successor, and this story is 100% apocryphal, almost certainly bullshit, but he tells his successor, like, he hands his successor two letters, and is like, you know, anytime you get into just incredible trouble, you open the first letter. You don't know your way out, just open that first letter. And eventually his successor gets into huge trouble, he opens the first letter, and it says, blame everything on me, it's all my fault, and say you're cleaning up the mess the last administration left. And so Khrushchev's successor goes out and does that, and things are okay for a while. And then he gets back into trouble, things are going under fast, and he opens the second letter. And the second letter says, write two letters. And I think that's kind of like, that's kind of what Zach Brown is in the first letter phase right now. Like, things have not gone well. There's Race Fans also had sort of a note that McLaren have missed their revenue targets, but Zach Brown is saying, like, he hit his advertising targets. He signed more sponsors than anybody on the grid. So he's doing his job. But his argument is that Ron Dennis left a really, like, dysfunctional company behind and a really dysfunctional management structure behind. And Brown is trying to fix all that. And he's trying to introduce a lot of, like, traditional hierarchies in the various departments. And his argument is that, like, there used to be a different management structure with a lot of, like, people having multiple lines of reporting in the structure. So you had, like, multiple bosses who could all, like, you know, get involved in other people's teams and divisions and really cause a lot of chaos. His argument is he's streamlining that and he's fixing it, and that'll put the team on a sound footing and make it comparable to the other teams on the grid. I don't know. Maybe. Like, it all makes sense, but at the same time, like, this era has just been so bad. You know? It's a little bit like the Horner and Alonso. Like, is it maybe part of it you?
And it doesn't, number one, it's been like this a long time, and it doesn't seem to be showing any signs of improvement.
Yeah, I guess the thing that turned me a little bit against Brown is in that documentary on Amazon, remember when they sort of unveiled a car to him, and like the team showing, he's his first look at the car, and the team's genuinely excited about, like, hey, the boss is going to look at the car.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of an asshole about the entire thing. He just starts complaining about like how it looks and how it's going to be tough to sell sponsorship because of the paint job and this needs to be changed. And like, yeah, people need to be perfectionists and demanding, but it was kind of hard to miss the degree to which he completely deflates the room around him.
Hmm.
And I don't know, like, leaders need to be a little bit like, you know, confidence building and a little bit inspiring. Ron Dennis was an asshole and made a lot of like unreasonable demands of his workers, but also he gave the impression of being driven and caring to a ridiculous degree about the health of the racing team. It was his passion. I'm not sure Zach Brown gives off that same vibe, and I'm not sure he's going to be the person to sort of bring this team out of the wilderness.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I guess we'll see, but I kind of agree with you in that, like, I don't see a lot of, like, shiny moments to point to or things to say, like, well, that could pan out well and that could probably be good. It's all just like, maybe they'll get better. Yeah, and that's kind of all we have.
And in his defense, what are you supposed to say at this point? Like, yeah. How's your chassis and aero? Bad. How's your engine? Not great. Like, what, like... You're basically starting over. Yeah. It's so
every
rough.
Year, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of yearly releases, I don't really have a good segue. I'm sorry. F1 2018, Rob. Number one, you should not believe anything we say because we ran an ad for F1 2018 on this podcast.
I didn't run an ad. Yes, I'm just here.
I ran an ad. Yeah, I ran an ad on F1 2018. Rob, tell me about F1 2018.
F1 2018 is not to be missed. No, F1 2018. It's tough for me to judge because I didn't play F1 2017 too much. Mm-hmm. So like, people I've talked to who play 2017 a lot. A lot of the good features in 2018 were already there in 2017. However. Playing 2018, as someone who took a couple years off, this is probably the most I've enjoyed this series in like 8 years. Basically since it started, maybe since 2011. It's really, really good. And the career mode is a lot of fun. The way they handle like on-track testing for car development is really rewarding and satisfying to dig into. Like... the fact that it teaches you different styles of attacking a track, like, okay, you need to turn a competitive time, but you need to do lift and coast on this time around the track. And, like, they give you pointers, like, hey, like, the best thing to do with lift and coast is, like, coast at the end of the fast straights and then accelerate fast in the sectors with lots of short straights and, like, get between the corners fast. But, like, it's the straights where you save a lot of your fuel. And accelerate gently, like don't over torque it at all. And so like, can you drive fuel efficiently around an F1 track? But if you're doing that, it's also going to completely change your braking points. It's going to completely change in a lot of cases, like even necessarily like your racing line, because you're coming to things so late, so differently. And the game kind of teaches you all of that. Like by the time like the race day comes around, you have this feel for your car and how it performs on the track, and you're able to do like, it's that feeling of like, hey, this is what it must be like to be a competent Formula One driver, where like you're out there and your battery is completely drained, you have to recharge it, but you do have some extra fuel, so you can run the rich fuel mixture, but your tires are also starting to go, so you need to conserve those as well. And you've built up the intuition. Yeah, you know what to do in that case.
In the weeds, racing stuff, not video game stuff. That's like, I haven't played all the modern racing games out there, but that's kind of amazing that a racing game is, and like a mainstream racing game, like the one that has Formula One written on it, is doing that stuff. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really rewarding to sort of develop that familiarity with the car. And it does make you like realize how much these drivers are probably doing with car settings during the race. Like I have not run a single race where I just start and point the car around the track and that's all I do. Every single race, I am futzing with the ERS settings, like every lap, changing where I'm, you know, using more boost and when I'm going to recovery mode. I'm tweaking fuel settings. It's really demanding and it's really rewarding. And the thing that really like makes it stick the landing, driving AI is really good. Like, really? I have not seen... If you play all the racing games, you get used to slot car AI. Mm-hmm. Where, like, they can take the line really well and run, like, fast laps, but they don't have any sense for how to actually race, how to actually pass, overtake. Not so this year. Like, this is probably some of the best on-track racing of any racing game I'm playing right now.
Wow.
There are... They make very good moves and aggressive moves, but not stupid ones. And when they make mistakes, and they do, it kind of like it kind of tracks. Like if Ricardo is trying to take you going around the outside of a corner, I've had a couple incidents in my career in F1 2018 with Danny Ricardo, and he makes contact with you trying to take the hard line on the outside of a corner. It kind of feels like the real thing. Like, I've seen that happen, like, multiple times on film. Yeah. And, like, now I'm living it. So, I mean, shit, I kind of love this game, man.
Wow. Great. That's great to hear. Should we go to driver standings?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. They're the same as last time, but we have a new race, so I figured I'd do a refresh here. Lewis Hamilton is on top with 213. Sebastian Vettel right behind with 189. I guess not right behind, but he's there. Kimi Raikkonen in third with 146, followed by Valtteri Bottas, 132. Danny Ric has 118. Max Verstappen, 105. And then a big gap down to Hülkenberg in seventh place with 52. Magnussen, 45. Alonso, 44. Perez and Sainz tied at 30, with Esteban Ocon right behind with 29. In 13th, we've got Pierre Gasly with 26. Grosjean's got 21. Leclerc with 13. Van Dorn with 8. Ericsson with 5. Stroll with 4. Hartley with 2. And Sergei Sirotkin bringing up the constructor standings. Mercedes on top with 345. Ferrari's in second with 335. Red Bull in third with 223. Renault's got 82. Gene Haas has 66. Force India with 59. McLaren's got 52. Toro Rosso with 28. Sauber's got 18. And Williams has 4. In the Fantasy League, by the way, invite code 0B62FE. Will also be on F1.cool if you can't remember that. Number one, Speedy McCreadys. Still holding it strong in first place, followed by Bois Party, Haas Tax Fraud, Bobby Gondo Racing, Orange B King F1, David Coulthard's Chin in sixth place, Trendsetters, Made in Haas, Scott's Tots, and Funky Bunch rounding out the top 10. By the way, you can now create multiple teams, up to 3 teams in F1 Fantasy. You can enter multiple teams into leagues, and you can create and join leagues that start from any race during the season. So a lot more options for that now. And let's roll right into racing around the world. What do you say? We've got a lot of racing going on. It seems like maybe multiple series have come back from their summer breaks. We got DTM. They're in Misano at the World Circuit, Marco Simoncelli. I heard that they might be changing the DTM name, which would be a real bummer because I like saying DTM. Formula 2 will be supporting Formula 1 at the Circuit de Spa-Francorchamps. Formula 3 Europe is also at the World Circuit, Marco Simoncelli. IndyCar is at the Gateway Motorsports Park. Supercars, the Australian kind, they're at the Bend Motorsport Park. And MotoGP is at Silverstone for the Octo British Grand Prix. And Camping World Truck is at the Canadian Tire Motorsports Park for the Chevrolet Silverado 250. Could it be? Is it true? There's no NASCAR this weekend?
Wait, the trucks are running.
the trucks are running, but the cup, what do we call it now? The Monster Energy Super Cup or something? I don't think the regular old NASCAR are running. Surprise.
I am heartbroken.
But Formula One is back. First practice starts August 24th. That's Friday at 2 a.m. Pacific time, followed by second practice at 6 a.m. Third practice on Saturday, August 25th at 3 a.m., followed by qualifying at 6 a.m. on Saturday. And the race, Rob, Sunday, August 26th at 6:10 a.m. I could not be more excited. Speaking of NASCAR, we got an email here at f1.cool/emails. The subject line says, NASCAR CEO feelings from a NASCAR fan. This is from Brian. Nope. It's from David. Not even close.
Sorry, Brian.
He says, hey guys, long time, first time. After being an F1 fan a couple years ago, mostly because of this podcast, that's awesome, I bought iRacing and started doing some online races. Good man. Long story short, turning left and right is hard, so I ended up doing mostly oval track races, and now I'm hooked. I've been a NASCAR fan for a few years now, and I think it might be worthwhile to give some insight into how fans of the left turn feel about this. He is referring to the NASCAR CEO being arrested for a DUI. And ceding the CEO spot to somebody else. Surprisingly, we're all pretty freaking excited in a decently dark or decidedly dark way about Brian France, that's the CEO, his exploits and having him step down. He's the CEO of NASCAR because he inherited it from his father, and he doesn't seem to have any passion for the sport. A lot of fans, myself included, are of the opinion that he should take a lot of the blame for the decline in viewership and the overall health of the sport. Most of us are viewing this as a pretty solid chance for the sport to get a breath of fresh air and hopefully benefit from a change in leadership. Basically, Brian France is the Bernie Eccleston of NASCAR, and he won't be missed by most of us. Love the podcast, and I look forward to continuing to listen. He also links some pretty good YouTube videos of NASCAR cars bumping into each other, like not only rubbing his racing kind of stuff, but like torpedoing each other. So I will link those in the show notes as well, because I don't know. NASCAR, I've watched it a few times. Seems like a good time. The one thing that kind of bugs me about it is that you can watch the whole race and then everything just changes in the last lap. So what did I do watching that whole race?
Do they do that thing? I haven't watched in ages, so maybe people can inform me. But definitely I noticed when I watched like Indy Oval Racing, there'd be just suspicious full course cautions for cleaning the track, which it's important. And you want those tracks to be clean and safe. Obviously you want them to be safe. I'm not sure you can make open wheel oval racing safe, as we unfortunately saw with the Wickens accident the other week.
Yes,
you know, well wishes to him. But IndyCar definitely felt like they were sort of massaging those gaps and making sure that the racing stayed close and competitive all the way to the checkered flag. And I'm kind of curious, like, do they do that a little bit in NASCAR as well? Like, do they? There's a certain accordion effect just with the way that racing works, but I am kind of curious, like, do they like to keep you guessing till the end? Do they maybe help it along a little bit?
Yeah, I don't know. That'd be David/Brian right back in. I'd love to know the answer to that. We have one more email here. This from Wes. He says, hey guys, I'm a big fan of your podcast and I'm a constant listener of it on Spotify. Interesting. Okay. I got into the sport shortly after the Australian Grand Prix, and I can't get enough of it. I usually root for underdog teams like Haas or Sauber, but the more and more I watch, I am consistently drawn to the red Ferrari, specifically Sebastian Vettel. I recently graduated from college and have moved into my own place away from my parents. This was a big step for my parents, since I am an only child. One of the ways that we have always connected, though, is through sport. I was hoping you guys might have some ideas on what F1 races/videos I could show them so that they would get into the sport. Forza Ferrari, Wes. What immediately comes to mind for you, Rob?
Oh, man. Trying to get your family. This is hard for me to relate to because my family has been in it for 20 years. I'm trying to think.
I would say if they're not motorsport fans, it's a harder sell. But I think you are aided greatly by the fact that two really good movies have come out recently. First of all, Rush, very watchable feature film that you don't need to be a motorsport fan to enjoy. Ron Howard directed it, so you know anyone
maybe
can,
his best
can watch
movie.
It. You think so?
Yeah, I think it's the one that feels least like a Ron Howard movie in a lot of ways. I think the most. It feels like the one with the most complicated central relationships, which okay. I don't usually associate with a lot of Howard movies. But yeah, I mean it's a sensational movie, and it's got it moves fast, and it does a great job of unpacking what's cool about the sport. It's a good pull.
Yeah, and then the other one would be Senna, which is a documentary, but also very well done. And I would say that you don't need to be a race fan to necessarily enjoy it. It really focuses on the man. But also gives you insight into how the sport works and, is more, it's closer to the modern era. It's, than Rush is. Rush is the 70s, 80s, and then Senna's more than 90s. I would also getting into Formula One requires, It's not a steep learning curve so much as it has a steep initial hump to get over. So I would say work on describing how things work, so that when you finally do sit down and watch a race together, which I would recommend doing, don't just have them watch a race, sit down with them and then be prepared to explain everything along the way. Because if you don't understand, first of all, get that emotional connection using the movies and then get the technical connection by explaining it. Because if you just are watching cars go around in a circle, it's not going to be enjoyable.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I would start with those movies, for sure. You mentioned one as well. Is that one you put on the list? That's
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and that Amazon documentary actually does a really good job of hey, here's what race driver, the McLaren look, which is
Grand Prix driver.
Grand Prix driver. That's right. Yeah. Also does a good job of sort of unpacking how the sport works, what it's like to be on the inside of it. And does set up some of the dramas we see today, which is, can McLaren get its act together?
Yeah.
So that's another good resource to tap into.
Yeah, I would again say that series is sort of a misnomer. It's not really about the Grand Prix driver. It's more about the team. But I think that's that. And actually, the Williams documentary is another really good look at
Williams documentary.
Yeah. Oh, you haven't seen that one?
No.
It's on Netflix.
We've talked about it on the show before, but yeah,
it's on Netflix. It's just called Williams.
Okay.
That is also a really interesting look into a Formula One team. They talk to everybody. They talk to it's mostly Claire. But that's quite a story. I would recommend that one.
Not a bad movie to watch would be, it's not about F1 necessarily, but it's so foundational to Ferrari, The 24-Hour War, which was Adam Carolla's documentary about the Ford Ferrari rivalry at Le Mans.
Okay.
And but it touches a lot on the early days of Ferrari and sort of the lineage there and how they approach racing and why it's so important to that team and that company. And it's a really interesting documentary and gives you some great insight into those old days of racing. And there's a lot of in those days. There's also a ton of crossover between endurance racing and F1. So these programs were not totally separable. So that's another good thing to help people get into racing.
Yeah. Well, good luck. That's always fun to have more people. Be able to talk to and watch with. So good luck with that. As always, you can find our show notes on f1.cool and in your podcast app. Until next time, I'm Drew Scanlon, Danny O'Dwyer again on why can I not
Patreon
remember
leave.
Patreon leave, that's right. Rob Zachney, where can people find you?
At Rob Zachney on Twitter, or you can check out what I'm up to over at Waypoint at waypoint.vice.com.
Excellent. Anything else from you, Rob, you want to send people into the next race with?
Boy, not really. Just prayers for rain, man. Like, I can't even... I don't even have a picture in my head of what Spa looks like with the sun out. I can't
right,
see
it's
it.
Always at least cloudy, yeah. I'm so excited. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next time.